How lucky are we? I had the great privilege and pleasure of watching The Eternal Daughter myself a few weeks ago. And for Tilda herself to be here to share with us her experience of the film, her experience of cinema in a broader sense as well, is a real special moment. And I'm sure you're all still coming out of the reverie that you've just experienced, because it's a hugely atmospheric film with an enormous amount to think about. Do you agree? Yeah, I see a lot of nodding heads. I think it's something that has a very special, casts a very special spell. So thank you. Thank you so much for coming and talking and sharing your experience with us.
You're so welcome. I just want to say, I don't know how many of you were here, but it feels like yesterday that I came here for the first time to hear you speak about The Girl with the Pearl Earring, because we happened to be spending that evening together, and I was very happy to come, not only to see you, as ever, my dearest friend, but to meet you and to meet this extraordinary cinema, which I'd heard about. And so we said then, I said, how can I come back? How can I support the cinema? And this film was coming along. So I said then, I'll come with the film. And here we are, 6 months later. And I'm really privileged, you know. Independent cinema, I don't just mean the making of it, but I mean the cinema audience, of which I am one, is so important to me. And your project here is really a beacon. So it's a real honour to be with you tonight.
Thank you. Shall we talk a little bit about the film? Yeah. So there are many things that I would like to unpack. And I think probably the first and most important part of that is your relationship with the authoring of this film. And that is, I see it as a collaboration between you and Joanna Hogg, the director, who would have liked to have been here herself today, but she's unfortunately unavailable. So can you tell us a little bit about Joanna, your work with her, and how you and she work together? This film, of course, is the third in a sequence of films, The Souvenir One, which also has Tilda's daughter Honor in a role, and Souvenir Two, and then this film is a cousin, would you say, of that?
It's a relation for sure. And for those of you who haven't seen The Souvenir One or Two, and I would stress that The Souvenir was always intended to be a film in two parts. It's not a film with a sequel. It's a two-part film. This is not a third part. This is a different film, but the two women are the same. It's just 25 years later, and this time I get to play the daughter and not my daughter, but I still play the mother. The story of my relationship with Joanna Hogg is, I think, I always feel you're my oldest friend, but actually Joanna and I have known each other for even longer. This Joanna and I have known each other since we were 18. We met at university. This is the godmother of my children. She's a very special person to me. Joanna Hogg and I met on our first day of boarding school when I was 10 and she was 11. And it's very interesting to us to notice, because in presenting this film around the world, as we've been privileged to do in the last year, we get to reflect on the fact that we have been having conversations about life, about a sort of way of observing life, and in particular about our mothers, since then. We've been having what I think of now as filmmakers' conversations since we were 10 and 11, and we never really stopped. For those of you who know who I mean by Derek Jarman, for many, many years I've said that Derek Jarman was the first filmmaker I worked with. It's not actually true. Joanna Hogg is the first filmmaker I ever worked with. I made her her graduation film in, I think, 1984. Hmm. And Derek is a very interesting link between us because he was also, at the time when I started working with him in 1985, he was mentoring Joanna and encouraging her to be an independent filmmaker. So he was like our sort of godfather umbrella. But Joanna and I, talking about our mothers, when we made the Souvenir films, which are the films, for those of you who haven't seen them, they are... It is a two-part film about Joanna's experience of becoming a filmmaker herself, and in particular, about a relationship that she had with a man that kind of blew her off course for a long time. I play the mother, and the mother is very much a sort of tangential character. She's important because she's the protagonist's mother, and mothers are always important, when we came to talk about this film, what we really wanted to look at was that relationship, that there's no other meat, really. We wanted to talk about how it is to understand or to even begin to approach making a piece of work about your mother and your relationship with your mother. And we started talking about me playing the daughter, because we wanted to make a film about a woman of our age. And for the longest time, I was going to play Julie, and we were talking about who we might find to play the mother. And we were looking, as is often the way in our work together, at people who are not performers, who haven't worked before in front of a camera. And then we'd made the Souvenirs by then, and we rather loved Rosalind, and I played Rosalind, and I was feeling a bit sad about not playing Rosalind, and then in a fit of sort of joke, I said, well, why don't I play both of them? And in that moment, the film, which you've now seen, was born, because now you see, because you've seen it, why it needed to be the same person playing the two people, because, spoiler alert, there's only Julie. There is no Rosalind. And Rosalind is a projection of Julie's. And so this kind of parlay is only really possible when you've known someone for 50 years. Mm. And so that's really a long-winded way of describing how a piece of work like this comes to grow out of a 10-year-old and an 11-year-old wondering about their mysterious mothers. You know, it really is... I'm sure most of you might have experience of a relationship like that, in an early childhood relationship, maybe a sister, maybe a brother, when you ask yourself these, you know, impenetrable questions about...
I wondered to the extent that you and Joanna met at that age, and that you were at a boarding school and you were parentless, whether this theme, whether you parented each other to us in the way that children have to do in the absence of grown-ups who are prepared to take the responsibility, and whether there's a parenting relationship between the director and the actor that switches at any time between you parenting the project for Joanna and Joanna parenting you in the making of it and the shoot or in any other aspect, and whether there's something essentially parental which leads into the theme of mother and daughter.
I think that's very interesting, but what it makes me prefer to say is that there was just the haven of fellowship. You know, we were, not to bring out the tiny violin too much, but, you know, we were high and dry. You know, we were young children, we were entirely alone, we were in a relatively threatening environment, and we saw each other across a crowded and very hostile environment, and we liked each other, and we were both quite quiet people, and we could see in each other that we were observant, and that's what we were really occupied in being. We're kind of trying to stay out of the way of the violence and abuse, it has to be said, and we took that was our home for the length of time we were there. Mm. Whether it meant that we What it does mean is that when we then ended up making work, we were the co-parents of the work.
Mm.
So I don't think we necessarily parented each other, but we kept each other company and we validated each other. And we were, you know, so nice that somebody didn't want to bully you.
It's a brilliant performance because you're not only doing one character, you're also playing the other character. And there are a lot of technicalities that you had to go through in the process of recording the two sides to that story. Can you tell us a bit about what that process involved? I mean, it's utterly brilliant.
Well, one of the things that was very challenging for us, having had this crackers idea, was for any of you who've seen Joanna's other work, she works in a very avowedly lo-fi way. As I say, there's never a screenplay. She doesn't write a dialogue at all. You know, everything is improvised. She writes a sort of short story, a sort of little architecture of what may be involved in a scene. Maybe every scene maybe has one line. You know, they have lunch for the second day. That's it. And then you figure out what you're going to say. And given that this idea of me playing both people really gripped us, we were very challenged by that because that immediately made us think, oh Lord, special effects. Oh Lord, gimmicks. You know, gimmicks and, you know, prosthetic makeup and distancing performance and all of this. And so we were, you know, it took some courage from both of us to keep faith with it. And then we tried to figure out a way of keeping it lo-fi within this conceit. And so there were a couple of things we did which were which paid off, I'm happy to say. I think paid off. First of all, we decided to dispense with any of the sort of, you know, dirty over-the-shoulder, looky-likey in the foreground thing. We just went portrait to portrait, portrait to portrait. And this was something that really felt like a feat of courage because we didn't know, I didn't know, whether a modern audience, which you are, which we are, could take that, because I didn't know whether we were so infected with the dirty close-up that we would miss it, that it would feel too alienating. And I don't know, you may disagree and you're absolutely within your rights to, but for my money, it works. It's okay. You don't mind that there isn't sort of some fuzzy earlobe and a bit of shoulder in the foreground. And that in itself, that technical fact, really freed us up. Because then what we could get down to was forging what these conversations might be, what this relationship might be. And so what we would do very practically, because it's a practical business, filmmaking, we would roll out of bed and go, okay, so now it's day one, what are we going to do? And we would go the first dinner. And we would decide roughly what was going to be approached in that first dinner. And we would sort of make a judgment about who might lead that conversation, who might be the instigator, really. And say, for example, we decided that Julie was the one who was beginning to ask the questions. Then I would play Julie first, and I would be, you know, made to look like Julie. And then Joanna would sit very close to the camera, and we would just riff for hours. And we would take the conversation up all sorts of trees and branches, and we would really suck that orange. And then once we felt we had really sucked the orange, then we would turn around and I would go and be made up as Rosalind. And then I would come back and then I would improvise to nothing, to my memory of all the possible, you know, to's and fro's of what Julie had done, where Julie had taken us. And there was something that came out of that, which I remember saying to you when we were in Lewis, that was really interesting. It was like an interesting psychological observation for me, which was just this thing that we don't always listen to each other. We certainly don't always answer each other, especially if we're a mother and daughter. And so it sort of gave us the license to not necessarily sort of tick all the boxes and you know, cross all the T's and dot all the I's. Sometimes Julie asks a question that doesn't get answered. Sometimes Rosalind will say something that just sort of into thin air. And that was, and being a, you know, it started out as an expedient observation, but I actually think it gives it a particular, it's like a writing observation. And I think it's encouraging. I mean, I think of it as a writer now, that it's encouraging to remember that you don't have to write people who listen to each other very well.
It makes it very natural. Yeah. It makes it feel very real, and the kinds of conversations that at some unconscious level you recognise to be true. It's a supernatural film.
Yeah, it's a ghost story.
A ghost story. And with all the, you know, shot during COVID, when in a way we lived in another realm, another part of our normal selves was suspended, and that eerie, atmospheric sense of another world, which is either in our psychologies and our lives, or possibly in the manifestation of death itself, all seems to seep through the film in a very beautiful way. I mean, did you think of it as, because on the one hand it's very improvised and naturalistic, and on the other hand it's extremely heightened and stylized. And how did you feel about marrying that?
When we figured out that, because we needed some boundaries, you're exactly right. I mean, as I say, we'd had this material swilling around between us since we were 10 and 11. So, you know, that's a dangerous possibility, because you do need a structure. You know, you've got to pour your liquid into some kind of vessel so it has some kind of shape. And we needed to find some limits. And we decided on this long weekend, these three nights. That felt so narratively very holding. We knew there was going to be a beginning, and we knew there was going to be an end. We knew that there was going to be a white taxi bringing them and a black taxi taking Julie and Louis away. We knew that first, and then we filled in the center of the chocolate. And then we decided that it was a ghost story. And once that sort of came clear, then we were able to fill it, and Joanna was able to fill it in a sort of stylistic way, which I think was, if she was here, I know, and I've heard her say, was really delightful to her, because she's never worked in that sort of genre, with that kind of genre vernacular before. And so we were able to really go to town with all the mists and the hearings and the sounds and the whole idea of haunting. And to play around, because of course it is, now you know, it's a ghost story, there is a ghost, but it's not who you think it is. and so we were able to really kind of spin that top, but with the feeling of being contained a little, with some kind of structure. That was clear, clarifying.
I often think that you know, that what we see in the end result in cinema is the truth, is the real truth. And I think that's evident in yours and Joanna's relationship, is palpably part of this story. But the other real truth is Louis, the dog, your real dog, one of Tilda's real...
I was with him this morning. I left him in Scotland. Yes, I wish he was here.
Can we talk a little bit about what he brings to the film for you?
Yeah. Well, again, for those who haven't seen the Souvenir films, my family's tribe of Springer Spaniels populate those films. The first film has the great Rosie, who's no longer with us. In fact, Louis lost his mother last year, just as Joanna lost her mother, and I'd lost my mother before that. So it is a film about bereavement through and through, not only us, but also Louis. Rosie and Dora, her sister, were in the Souvenir Part 1. And then they were joined by Snow Bear in the Souvenir Part 2. Recipients, may I say, of the Palme d'Or in Cannes. And then when it came to the Eternal Daughter, because it was the same women, the same family, of course, they had to have the next generation of Springer Spaniel. And I had had Louis up my sleeve for a solo role because he was maybe going to contribute to the Souvenir Part 2, but I remember saying to Joanna, no. He needs a star appearance. He's not a member of the chorus. and as you can see, I was correct about that. He's an extraordinary... I mean, you know, joking apart, there's something... Oh, I'm going to cry. Oh, God. But there's something about him. And I, you know, one of my favourite films and one of my favourite performances of all time is O Hazar Balthazar, about the donkey of Bresson. And having Louis in this as the griever, because he's the griever, you know, he's Rosalind's dog. Mm. And he's telling the truth all the time. Mm. And Julie isn't. Mm. Julie's not. I mean, see how moved I am by Louis. Mm. You know, he's telling the truth. If you look, the second time you see the film, you look at him, he's in a state of grief. Mm. Mm.
And he is... His real presence and his real relationship with you, Tilda.
Yes.
Neither Rosalind nor Julie, but Tilda is therefore brought into the screen and part of the story. Yeah. And the moment when he disappears, you know, I mean, I know this, I used my own dog on a TV show once and she had to be sacked on the grounds that she escaped out of a scene. She was very ill-behaved and... attacked as a miniature pony, and then following that, it was only stopped by a group of llamas, and that actually, but she was literally sacked the next day.
What got into her?
Her natural spirit.
But
my point being that a trained dog, which I'm having worked with animals that are trained for a specific role, they always disappoint. Because they're trained to do something and it's not real.
I made a film with Pedro Almodovar, The Human Voice, which is during lockdown, which is basically a woman and a dog. And we had this superstar, Spanish superstar, who has got his own line of incredible and very lucrative, no doubt, television commercials. He's amazing. He's got these bright blue eyes and he's phenomenal. And he had no interest in me whatsoever. He was really interested in his person who stood behind me with a sausage in his pocket. And he never looked at me once. Mm. And we actually had to rewrite sections of the film where I was had to say, this dog is not interested in me, because it was so clear that he wasn't. Mm. And Louis, I mean, we actually played a game when we were shooting, which was we felt was going to be useful in the cut, but actually we never used it. When he left... He left Julie's frame to go into Rosalind's frame, and he was the conduit between the two of them, because, of course, he was as interested in Julie as he was in Rosalind, which was very handy. No, his dedication, and he's a particular kind of dog and a particular kind of film star, he's like the sort of clearinghouse of the film.
Yeah.
Because he's the only one who's really kind of
He's in real. It. He's real, real, real. And we see all the realities of the other aspects of that place, time, and the fictions, and we can see them all in relationship to each other. But he provides us with the control to that experiment.
And also, I saw it not that long ago, and I was again amazed. There's the moment when Rosalind expires and Louis scrapes at my arm and whimpers. I mean, he can read thoughts or what, I don't know. He really is. So
I had a dog who wouldn't let me rehearse or learn lines in her presence, because she hated pretending. She could see the difference between pretending and realness. And she just, so if I said something in a voice or just trying something on, she wouldn't let me do it. I had to look, put her in a different room to learn lines. And I also know of another actor story where they were rehearsing. He'd taken a dog to rehearsal, and there was somebody aggressed the character. One character aggressed another character, and the dog attacked. You know, so there's just something very interesting. For me, it's not so much about the cuteness of dogs as the way in which cinema reveals truth.
Well, it's like that hilarious nonsense about never work with children and dogs. Children and dogs are the best people to work with because they only tell the truth and there's no acting. Mm. Less actors, I would say.
Shall we open up to our patrons here now to see if anybody has any questions for Tilda? And then I don't know how long we've got left, Heather. We've got... Yes, OK. So I think Philip had a question to start with, didn't you, Philip?
Hi, Tilda. I'm Philip, the programmer here.
Hi, Philip.
Hi. Talking about working with children, so there's this very... I don't know if it's completely unique in cinema history, but you're taking a character that was played by your own daughter, and now you're taking that over. What was that like for you and Honor, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, you'd have to ask her, and sadly she's not here, what it was like for her. The interesting thing for the three of us, for Joanna and Honor and I, about Julie and Rosalind Hart, is that they are a sort of melange, sort of hybrid of the three of us. Julie is part Joanna, part Honor, and part Tilda. And Rosalind is part Joanna's mother, part my mother, and part me. But the good news is, after three films, they really do exist in their own right, I feel. I feel I know Julie really, really well. She's not Honor. She never really was. And one of the things that was so impressive about Honor's performance in the Souvenir films as a raw animal, that she really played a person who isn't that close to herself. And she's not exactly Joanna, age 20, either. But she's a person that we all recognize. And the same with Rosalind, I would say. Rosalind's not exactly my mother or exactly Joanna's mother, but she's someone that our mothers will have known very well. And I know her. I met her when I was young. I know her very well. But it was interesting to... download some of my, not so much Honor herself, but Honor's performance as Julie. It was a really interesting thing. And she did recognize, in fact, she did tell me when she saw it before Christmas that there were a couple of shots that she thought were her, which I thought was amazing. And that says everything for our DP and our extraordinary crew and the light. But yeah, it's a trip. We share it. It's a sort of weird cousinly relationship we have with those hearts. Mm.
Mm. Anybody else who'd like to?
I feel quite nervous, but I'd just like to know how the title of the film emerged and the symbolism really of the title.
Well, it was Joanna who coined the title, but I know maybe what she would say if she were here. It's a title born out of her experience of being a woman who has no children of her own, and who felt, when we shot this film, up until the edit, Joanna's mother was still alive. She was very frail at the end, and she actually died during the editing. But Joanna was always aware, up until at the end of her mother's life, and she was in her 90s, that there was this particular role for her as eternal daughter, knowing that she would never be mother. So I think that's what she would say. I mean, the film is about grief, pre-grief, as well as post-grief, if you like, and that, as we know, is a long road, and it's you know, even the projection, the thought of it before, is enough to get one fantasizing about how it's going to feel when it comes.
Mm. Do you think that in relation to the Eternal Daughter as a concept, that the daughterness of us remains an eternal part of us?
That's such an interesting question. I mean, there's a sort of there's a line or a sort of guy rope that I held on to all the way through the making of the film and now, which is my basic interest in the film, or rather in the material of the film, which is this question: where does my mother end and I begin?
Mm. Mm.
And where do I end and my mother begin? Mm. And that's a question, in my experience, having lost both of my parents, and other people who I feel mixed up with. It's just a question for life. It's how does one disentangle oneself, especially from one's parents, and go on living? How does one survive one's parents? Mm. How does one survive? How does a daughter, specifically, survive a mother's disappearance?
Mm.
And and one of the things that sort of led to this very strange, bonkers suggestion of mine that I play both, was my observation myself when my mother died. I noticed, because I looked after her, I was in the privileged position to look after both my parents before they died and afterwards. And I was aware of I had a little weather eye out on my own behavior. I noticed, for example, that even before my mother died, I started to use language that only she would use. Or I would dress a little more like her when I was around her, when I was looking after her. And certainly after she died, I would wear not only her own particular cardigans or shoes, but I felt this sort of... And the same with my father, frankly.
Mm.
I mean, when I'm in my father's house, which I have the privilege of looking after now, I wear his trousers. Mm. It's just a thing we do, I think. I don't think I'm alone. Mm. And it gives comfort. But more than giving comfort, I do think it's a question of identity.
Mm. Mm.
We are confused about who we are. And that observation was something I remember sharing with Joanna.
Mm.
And that fueled this idea that I would play them both. I nearly said we would play them both. For the reason of that entanglement and that sort of trying. And maybe what happens, and I say this because my mother died 10 years ago, I've given up trying to disentangle.
Mm.
I just go, okay, we'll leave that there. I'm like her in this way and I'm like him in that way, and I'm completely like myself in this other way, and let's just let it lie.
Well, I think there's a great truth in the film. It may have been to a certain extent, a happy accident, you playing both roles. But there is a great truth to that, because they are, a mother and daughter are one to some extent. And that's there's a simpleness in that, but there's also the full complexity.
And there's the complexity of this ongoing push me, pull you, of trying to escape and being attracted and wanting to merge.
Mm.
And that just goes on and on and on, doctor.
and why that becomes something more than therapy is
because
the artistry that's brought to this project is partly made possible by having a third party in it, so that it becomes more than just a dialogue around one's own mother, which would have been potentially reductive.
Exactly right. And I think there were a couple of decisions, or rather attention, but points of attention that we had that really focused us. One was the things that were going to be the same, and one was the things that were going to be different. And one of the decisions we made was that they had the same voice. the same timbre of voice. I remember in the first day of shooting, I was strangely tempted to have a special Rosalind voice, and we just pared it away and pared it away because we felt it was wrong. And then the point of difference was the language. And this I found extremely fulfilling, as it really drew on the writer in me, because the language that Rosalind uses is a language that I don't use and that Julie doesn't use, but it's a language that my mother and my grandmother used that we recognize very well. And I don't know where it came from. It was a form of incarnation, but there are turns of phrase that she employs that are so distinct, and I would sadly say almost lost now. And it was such a pleasure to revive them. So just twizzling
somehow
between.
You opened a little channel into.
It was like a wavelength. You know, it was like a wireless. You know, trying to find a. Yeah. You know, when I was wearing Rosalind's wig, I would sort of twiddle the dial and get onto her wavelength. And,
yeah. It's quite remarkable to be able to do that, and a great emotional. A way to be emotionally be present, because you're going into something that's unconscious and about the past, and it matters, you know. Is there anybody? Yes, the lady in the silk top. Well, silky.
Hi. It's me.
Hello.
Really interesting to hear about the sort of universality of the relationship between mother and daughter. When I was watching the film, for me, many of the exchanges struck me as particularly British, particularly in ways that sometimes emotions were pushed aside and, you know, tears would just be ignored. And as an Australian and a Chinese person, it strikes me as particularly British. And I just wonder if that was something that you and Joanna had reflected on.
When you use the word British, which I say as a Scot is not a word that I tend to recognise, do you mean English, or are you talking about class?
I mean English.
You'd mean English specifically. I would say, I would go further and say that these women are clearly born into a class, that Rosalind is a woman of a certain generation, the generation that my mother and Joanna's mother came from, post-war, what I would call owning class, who had a kind of way of being a mother, which has been the source of this sort of endless mystery sort of adventure for Joanna and I for so long. It feels to us that there was a sort of deal they made, that generation of English women, although my mother was Australian, I can tell you that. But she was a kind of class of Australian who was brought up to be that kind of English woman. So we are talking about class. Rosalind and her sisters seem to have made a deal about being a kind of mother who didn't entirely show themselves to their daughters. They made it a deal that they would, it was a kind of narrative. It was to a certain extent a fairy story around an edited version of themselves as women. You're on the money. You're completely on the money. there's this moment in the film when Julie says to her, "You're this mystery person," and that was something that I have said many, many times, never actually to my mother, but about my mother and Joanna too. There's this sense of a kind of almost a play. It's almost a fiction. And then you have these daughters, and Julie, Joanna, and I, and Joanna, we're the same age, we're all artists. And so these women, these mothers have these artist daughters born in the 60s. What are they going to do with us? How are they going to relate to us? Mm. How are they going to keep the narrative going with these inquisitive, intellectually free, politically radical young women? I mean, I think this is a really very touching material for us. Mm. And then at the end of their lives, when you don't want to fight anymore and you don't want to be estranged and you don't want to be at odds and you want to be gentle and you want to be nurturing and you want to be mothering of your mother, you want to be kind and you want to be forgiving. That's what it's all about, you know. And yeah. How do you forge that mothering, nurturing, caring atmosphere around this mystery, around mm. this sort of lack of real understanding and one could say honesty. And so all these secrets, all these, you know, we haven't discussed a very important character in the film, which is the bag of papers, mm. the plastic bag. Mm. The plastic bag of mysteries. I mean, what are those mysteries? I mean, it doesn't matter. It was obviously very important to Rosalind and women like Rosalind to hang on to these secrets and for their children never to know that they were ever unhappy.
Mm. Mm.
I mean, I do think, and women of my age who are mothers, well, speaking for myself, I'm not going to generalize, but I know that it was very important for me when I became a mother to make sure that my children do know me. They really know me, and they know the way around me, and they know that I've been unhappy, and they know that I'm happy, and they know that I'm a human and an adult, and it's possible to survive being an adult. And, you know, that it's all to play for.
And you don't have a plastic bag full of things that they are not
no.
not allowed to no. ask about.
That might threaten them.
Yeah.
Because as we know, I mean, I was brought up by a father who was a war hero, was wounded in the war. He had one leg. Never discussed. Mm. Never, ever discussed that he hobbled around with one leg. Mm. But as we know, not talking about things doesn't mean that they go away. And it doesn't mean that you're not incessantly curious about them. And in fact, they become very, very compelling. Mm.
Mm.
What you ask about the very core of why Joanna and I wanted to make this film, this chasm between, there's always a gap between generations. I mean, my daughter Honor and I were very close, but I was born in 1960, she was born in 97. We have completely different experiences of the world, however close we are. But it feels to us that the gap between my mother born in 1929 and me born in 1960 was a chasm. It was massive. It feels like it was bigger, do you think, maybe, than any gaps that come since. And that's probably to do with the war and also to do with just evolution and history and social change and the women's movement and all sorts of things that...
Mm.
And the idea of sacrifice. I mean, my sense of those women is that they took great pride in making great sacrifices.
Mm.
My mother, you know, bless her, she wouldn't mind me saying this because she's fully evolved now. She, I know, really would have loved to have gone to university. I think she was super bright. But she was born into a world which meant that the most important thing was that she married someone and she had lots of children and went and lived in Scotland and ran a big house and all that kind of stuff. But she had that. That was her plastic bag sitting there.
I think we could actually have an encounter group on this because I can feel in the room there are people, there are nods and there are... It's a film that evokes a lot of thought and a lot of identification. And I don't think... I think it's the eternal daughter, but I think it could also be the eternal child in the sense that I don't think it... I mean, there are specifics to do with women and the condition of women, but I think there's also the condition of being a parent and a child. Shall we have one more question? And then I just want to finish up with a conversation...
That lady in the silky top.
The silk... the lady with the dark hair.
Is it silky? Should we come and feel it? It's not silky. Okay.
The trick of the light.
Hello, I've got so many questions, but I'll only ask one. The actress that played... Can I say actress or actor?
Whatever.
The person who's the receptionist, I thought she was brilliant. I loved her mannerisms. She was so rude, though.
Yeah.
In reality, how would you have handled that? Exactly the same as you did, or would you have said something to her?
I'm a terrible coward when it comes to being served in any way. I always feel terribly bad about anybody serving me. So I think I would have been very whipped by her. In a similar sort of way. She is really fantastic. That's her first film she was in, first piece of work, actually. She'd just come from drama school and has a really beautiful way with her, and is Welsh.
Mm. And it was filmed in Wales, which is where I come from, North Wales.
But I think, I think she was a very important... I don't like to talk about character because I feel that's a slightly theatrical term, but the sort of linchpin of the receptionist was very important because in many ways she represents society, she represents humans. And in a way, and one can see this maybe having seen it once, maybe the second time you see it, you might understand what I mean by this. Now that we know that Julie is grieving, she made this plan to come here with her mother, which is why she wanted the room with the wheelchair access. And now she doesn't need it anymore because her mother is no more. She's in deep grief. And as we know, in that state, one is a little removed. One's not really. I mean, I believe wholeheartedly in the Victorian tradition of wearing black for a year. Mm. My family and I are grieving right now for my children's father, and I wish we were able to wear black. I think it's really sensible. I think black for a year, and then grey for, you know, half a year after that, and then violet for the year, half a year after that. And then we're allowed to drive cars and, you know, pay bills. But you can't really do anything for the first 2 years. And she's in that sort of heightened, elevated, removed state. Mm. And of course, Rosalind, as we know, is removed entirely, and then Louis is the truth teller. But Carly, the receptionist, she is humanity and she's society, and she's the one with the battle with her boyfriend, with the loud music, and she's the one with the kind of critical eye. And there's something I think very heartbreaking about the way she's watching out for Julie, and at the end she witnesses her with this tragic moment with the birthday cake. Because of course there's only Julie, and she's seen her for 3 nights sitting, talking to an empty chair. And when she asks her at the end, "Are you all right?" I think it's really beautifully played. Mm. But it was very important that she be tough, that she's really a horrid thing for Julie to deal with.
She's in the real world and she's living.
She's living, you know, and she's putting on lipstick.
Like a Parisian waiter.
One last question, yes?
That's me. Thank you for allowing me the last question. Fantastic film, brilliant performances. Thank you so much. As we've been talking about grief, there's also the character of Bill, who introduces another level of grief.
Yes.
And that scene with Bill and Julie, I found deeply moving. Yeah. I wonder if you could say something about what Bill's function served in the storytelling.
Another incredibly important person, impossible to imagine the film without him. He sees Rosalind. You know, Carly's character doesn't see Rosalind, but he does, and he is in touch. And in many ways, you know, we were inspired a little by The Shining, but also there's something about him as an angel. He has that sense of that Wim Wenders film, the Himmelüber Berlin. What's it called in English? The angels. What's it called?
Wings of Desire.
Wings of Desire. You know, the idea of him being a witness and being able to access. And Joseph Mydell is such an extraordinary person, and he brings with him this deep sort of just beyond compassion. He's just, you know, he has real wisdom, and he really sees it all. And he's a fellow griever, And that was really important for Julie. Because I think even within the sort of template of the first time you see the film and you think that Rosalind is still alive, it's clear that Julie is preparing. She's sort of setting out her stall. I remember you and I, years and years ago, we did that play together about Joan of Arc. Mm. And there was a character played by the great Patricia Routledge, a nun. This was a play that Jana played a nun and Patricia played a nun and I played Joan of Arc. And there was an amazing moment when Patricia Routledge's nun says, always put a bit of grieving by, which I have never forgotten and serves me to this day. It's such a wise thing. Mm. And I think that's what Julie is attempting to do, is to put a bit of grieving by and prepare. And Bill's there as a sort of, he's there as a witness. There's this moment at the end, I don't know if anybody noticed, the very end when Julie's leaving, that a young man is bringing his father in a wheelchair in. He's the next. So there's something about this house as being a sort of, it's a sort of clearing house of grief.
Resolution. How do we have any more time, Heather? 5 minutes. Thank you very much, everybody, for questions. I just wanted to finish off with a little... there is no greater supporter of independent cinema from the body of actors in Britain than Tilda. And that's been from... You, I remember, turned your back immediately on the offers of what... would seem to have been sort of plum roles and so on from a very young age, just after we'd left university, because of seeing, I think, another path, another way of creating cinema, and also enjoying cinema and participating as consumers and as, in a sense, co-creating by being the audience as well. Can you talk a little bit about your own relationship with British independent cinema, grassroots cinema, and also how that relates to a global conversation?
Yes, I'm very happy to talk about that because it's something I really, it's like the battery of my working life and to, in many ways the battery of my life. I had the great good fortune to not have any ambition to be an actor, but I did learn very early that I wanted to make work with people. I was, as you know, when I first went to university, I was a writer, I was a poet, and I knew what it was to make work alone. But the second I got to university, I stopped writing, which was a minor, well, pretty major crisis, actually. And then I started to meet people who were doing plays. They were performing. And even though I'd performed in plays at school, you know, very enthusiastically and enjoyed it very much, I never thought of myself as being an actor. I was not interested in it at all. But in this sort of moment of not being able to write, I started hanging out with these other people who were very serious, you know, directors who became professional directors and actors who became professional actors and writers who became professional writers. And they were at Cambridge, they were a very kind of, you know, proper, hardcore group of people. And I just fell in with them and started being in plays and enjoyed them. But I was sort of licking my wounds, really, as a writer. And then when we left Cambridge, I went on being an actor for a bit, but I was just trying to find the exit off the motorway to authorship, because that's really what I was looking for. And I always knew that being an actor was a sort of, you know, very much a diversion. And then I met Derek Jarman, and Derek Jarman was, and we're talking about 1985, is a very long time ago, in a very different environment, filmmaking environment. In those days, very briefly, I would characterize the kind of scene at the time as being an incredibly healthy television industry and really almost non-existent film industry. There was an international kind of galactic David Lean film industry, by the way. And I have to say one very, very, very personal thing. I auditioned for David Lean. I was actually going to be in his film of Nostromo. Yeah, it's amazing to sit in his cinema here now. And one day I'll tell you the stories about sitting with him. But anyway, but there wasn't really, there were sort of a few people making big industrial international cinema like Alan Parker and David Lean and a few other people, and David Putnam and people like that. And then there was amazing television. And then there was an art cinema funded almost exclusively by the BFI. Thank the Lord for them. Always, On We Go, another BFI film just now. I stick with the people that fed me forever. And they were looking after people like Derek Jarman, Sally Potter, Ron Peck, Peter Greenaway. And what they were doing was saying, listen, it's not just this film, but your entire voice I'm interested in, and we'll give you a tiny bit of money, 200,000, to make this film, but what we're really into is your voice as a filmmaker, and we'll be there for the next five. And so there was this culture, which in those days we called underground. It was art cinema, and that's where I found a way of working, not just with Derek, also with Sally Potter, and also with Peter Wallen, with Friendship's Death and Orlando. It was a culture of co-authored filmmaking. It was like a collective. And Derek, of course, was paramount amongst all of these filmmakers. He ran his films like you know, someone holding a party, and really good parties. And what I mean by that is, you know, as anybody knows, what you need when you're throwing a good party is people who are going to all own it. You want people who are going to come and give good guest. And everybody who came onto those sets was given absolute freedom to author their own department. So Sandy Powell was able to develop her work, and she should come here, by the way. You should get her here to talk about her work. Costume designer, started out, she and I, first film we made together was Caravaggio. She'd just come from art school, and she's gone on to work with Martin Scorsese pretty endlessly ever since. And she was given absolute license to do whatever she wanted with her costume departments, just as the same as all of us who were performing, and Christopher Hobbs, who designed, and Simon Fisher-Turner, who did the composing of the music. And Derek just gave us authorship of our own worlds. And that was very empowering. And I worked with Derek for 9 years until he died in 94. And I'd made seven films with him, and Friendship's Death, and Orlando. So by the time he left, I just had my drug. You know, that's the way I wanted to work. And I didn't know, and I still don't know, how to work in a professional actor's way. And that way is the way I've consistently gone looking for, like a truffle hound. And I found it in quite weird places, you know. Sometimes I found it in studios in America, actually. Big Hollywood studios sometimes are, you know, being occupied by people like David Fincher or Francis Lawrence, who are auteur filmmakers. They're just working with many, many more millions of dollars and bigger crews, but they're still trying to kind of forge the form. And so I think that co-authored, very personal kind of material is what I've always been interested in, and I've never had to give it up, thank the Lord. You know, they've always continued. And the joke of sitting here now talking to you about that film made with my friend I've known since I was 10 is that, in a way, nothing's changed. It's just gone on for 30 years, and we've come back to the beginning again, me and Joanna working together again.
Well, we are so glad to have you make this film that we can watch, and not just watch as, you know, to enjoy, but also to give us something. I think the arts, all the arts, they start a conversation in the self and in amongst each other. And I mean, and I know that if I now said we can all go into the bar and talk till, you know, kingdom come, we would. And that we would have a conversation, and people would share their life, their aspects of what it is to be a daughter, what it is to be a mother. what it is to be a child or a parent, and that's the purpose of art, is to bring us together to have this conversation. Mm-hmm. And thank you for making another opportunity to have a very important conversation, and be part of, you know, we're in Croydon. I'm so impressed by the level of participation in the arts at all levels. We have fantastic music. We have got amazing performance and dance work through Croydon Nights. We've got it's humming. You know, it genuinely is humming, and that's something that I'm proud to be able to introduce you, as it were, to a world which is genuinely participatory, because I know how much you value participation.
I really do, and I can feel it. And it's not just that you've told me about it, but I can feel it. And I live in a village in the north of Scotland, and I don't know. I think it's possible. I was going to say that one of the things that characterises the sort of filmmaking culture that I feel very embedded in is this sense of community. Mm. It's not just that we collectively make the films, but we share it not only with the audience, but in the audience. We've always known we had the audience. We're part of it. And there was never this feeling of being professionals showing something or pulling any wool over the eyes of some punters. You know, that whole vernacular is not the point. And I know, because I live out with any kind of urban conurbation, that maybe this is where, in the suburbs, which I imagine we're in now, or in the villages where I come from, where I've run cinemas and curated film festivals and taken, you know, a mobile cinema around the villages and lochs and glens of the Highlands of Scotland, that real participatory film culture lives there in a completely even-handed way, because it's absolutely living. It's not a sort of... there is no professional divide.
Yeah.
It's really about a community.
Yeah.
And I think you have this here. And I don't know. Maybe it's not true that it doesn't exist everywhere. Maybe it exists in the middle of the big cities too. Mm. But it's just there are more distractions maybe there. But it's all about community.
I think that word community is the key. Tilda, thank you for absolutely fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Lovely way to start the year.
And a brilliant performance as well. A very brilliant performance. Thank you. Oh my God. Brilliant.